Today on Care Under Fire, I'm with Baha Alassadi. Baha was born in Iraq and worked as a coalition interpreter during the ISIS invasion of Iraq before migrating to Australia with his family and commencing his diploma in nursing. It's great to catch up again. I'm so thankful you agreed to coming on the podcast to share your story.
Thank you so much, Emma. First of all, congratulations for doing such an amazing podcast. And thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this. It is like truly an honor to share my experience with like your audience. And I believe we'll have a fantastic time chatting. By the way, I've listened to some of your episodes and look forward to listening to more in the future. So just keep up the good work.
Thanks. So tell me about your younger years growing up in Iraq. Did you grow up in Baghdad, and what was that
yes.
like?
So I was born in 1991 in Baghdad, which is the capital of Iraq. I was born and raised in a family of five brothers, and the area that I lived in was like, I would say one of the best areas in Baghdad. And like many famous Iraqi actors, officials, like important figures used to live in that area. And I come from like a middle class family, so nothing was luxurious about my lifestyle. but still, like, dad taught us like the best lesson in life, and that is, you know, never show people what your status is and always be thankful for what you have. And he always used to mention that if you have like $1 or like $1,000 in your wallet, your attitude should stay the same.
Yeah.
And you just must be humble and like show kindness always to people. Yeah, and about like my education was, I mean, this was actually like number one priority in our family. And I have three brothers, are engineers, and the fourth one just finished bachelor degrees in Spanish. And I have finished bachelor degrees as well in English language and literature in University of Baghdad. That was back in 2012-2013. Yeah, and right before like I graduated, I started my first job, which was a receptionist at a hotel. And I worked for almost a year and then found like the interpretation job.
So you learned English as a little boy?
I was I started learning English since I was five, I guess. I had a dictionary and like memorizing words, and you know, I'd ask my family. My dad is good in English and French as well. So yeah, it started since I was too young, actually.
Yeah, so speak Arabic at home and then just learnt it at school, practice with your family, but then they had all these other amazing like Spanish and French and that happening as well.
That's correct. Yeah,
yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So was there kind of a lot of sectarian violence in your neighbourhood, or were you exposed to that in wider Baghdad as you were growing up?
Look, growing up in very complex and challenging environment, especially like with the significant changes that occurred after 2003. Again, we're speaking about like a generation that lived during the transition from good to bad, I would say it, from a time of like harmony among diverse groups to marked, like really, really marked sectarian by the situation that happened after 2003. Sectarian was never a thing before 2003, as like there was so many diverse people from different sects, different religion, lived in the same area, but never felt absurd, like as if they were living as one family, okay?
Yeah.
And we never knew what sectarian violence was, actually. And I mean, you just see love, support from everybody. But after 2003, like the quality of mentality of people started to change due to the the influence of many factors. And as freedom came along, and so many like political changes as well, And you know what? The invasion that happened to Iraq, it's not the only factor that really changed the mentality of people. So there are so many different shapes and types of like factors and, you know, influences that happened. And one of them I would mention is technology. Okay. It came in like in no time and had a great impact. And it was like an eye opening for many people. So some of them actually deviated and their minds were like manipulated because of the technology, but other people didn't have the chance to be introduced to technology for whatever reason until the very late years, and invested like this kind of influence, this kind of impact in a better way. So before 2003, like small groups were oppressed by the rule of family, by like Saddam regime. But afterwards, I mean, they started to get stronger. Those small groups, they started to get stronger and stronger and bigger. So those kind of people who really introduced the like this kind of violence to the society, they brought this sectarian like to the table. And I mean, they began to have more power over like many resources. So this was also like one of the reasons that initiate sectarianism, as like every group is trying to defend their territories. And you know what? This is mine. You know, you're not taking over this. I mean, so they start to get stronger. And you know what? This is what spread sectarianism in the area. And again, dad advice is always absolutely wise. So as he like kept us very, very cautious about like the discussion with friends and family, and you know what, always be careful what you're talking about.
So you were basically born when the first Gulf War was happening, is that right?
Sorry?
We call it the first Gulf War, but basically, the US-led coalition invaded Iraq around that 1990-91 mark when you were a baby.
Yep, so it was, I think, right before when the war finished.
Yeah, and then they ousted Saddam Hussein in 2003, and then that sort of sectarian violence probably become more prominent post-Saddam, you say.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow. Yeah. So, growing up, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? Or you just kind of fell into that interpreter role after your first job?
Yeah, so like typical answer for like a young kid is like when asked about what you want to do when you grow up is being a doctor.
Yeah.
So I've never thought myself like being a health sector, or like, you know what, studying nursing, so this is what I'm doing at the moment. I've never thought myself like I'm gonna do this at all, okay? And but being an interpreter, yes, due to like being introduced to English from my early years, I was always like very interested in like learning English. So as I mentioned, like I had a dictionary of like a English Arabic dictionary when I was around 5, and I used to like memorize words, talk about them like with my family, and again like in primary school, I mean they teach us English definitely, but it starts from grade 5, and I was like so eager to reach grade 5, to be honest, just to see how like and what kind of stuff we will learn. Because I've already know a lot before that, you know? And yeah, and I was like amongst the best students around that time in like in English, because yeah, I know a lot before that. So, and I used to have a slightly different mentality than other kids back then. And as I mentioned, like I love learning English. And I used to listen to a lot of like music and songs in English, especially like after 2003. And some of my friends I know started to work with the American forces, like as freelance interpreters. And at the same time, I could notice, like from a distance, that their financial state has changed and they've started like to access different facilities and stuff. And that was like not allowed for people like me. Okay. So some of these friends that I knew that worked with the Americans, they didn't even have the education like to work as interpreters. They've learned English just by like interacting with people and like with the Americans especially. And I remember I was 12 years old. That's when like when the war started in 2003. And after that, like seeing those people like working with the Americans and as interpreters, and always thought to myself, like, why not me? Why not me working as an interpreter with them? But again, my father was so no. That's a big no. You need to finish your school. You need to finish your studies first. And I still remember his exact words: finish your school and then pursue the career that you want and whatever job you feel like you want to do in the future. Like now, I agree 100% with him. But back then, I was too young to think about this and how life would go. And I still remember like some of my friends in high school. I used to have big arguments with my friends and especially my English teachers about like pronouncing words and, you know what, like how to say them correctly. And the funny thing, I used to get so many extra marks for that just to prove my teacher is wrong and I'm right.
I guess depends a lot on accent and country of origin too, because there's lots of discrepancies in the English language, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the role of an interpreter, absolutely essential in delivering healthcare. If you can't communicate with people, you can't treat them, you can't work out what's wrong. It's really, really difficult. But it's a role that doesn't really get highlighted, I don't think, often enough. How did you find it?
So I will share a little story about how things started. So in grade 12, before like I graduate, I failed two subjects and I had really, really bad marks in that year. So I've decided to repeat the grade 12. Oh, sorry, year 12. Yeah, year 12, equivalent to the Australian system. And I still remember my mom rushed to my room 2 weeks before the final exams, like the second attempt for the final exams. And she was like, look, Baha, you're not going to repeat the year again, okay? You're not going to do this again. We provided you with everything. We've done what we've done to you, and you have to study those two subjects and pass and get whatever grades you will get. And you know what? Just deal with it, okay? And I was like, you know what, Mom? I'll do it. I don't want to get too frustrated about this. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it, okay? So I did take the exams and I passed. And then I've got really bad grades. And I went to the university where I finished my studies. And I saw there is advertisement saying that you can do a private test, and it's an English test, and there are some like requirements and I mean things that you have to provide and stuff before you attempt the test. But you will be accepted in this university in this field if you pass the test. And I did actually pass the test, and I've got my education. I've got finished in University of Baghdad. And after I graduate, I told you my first job was a receptionist, and then I found the interpretation job through one of the companies that used to stay at the hotel where I used to work. And I've started with Americans first, and then worked with the Australians. So, and first of all, Emma, I want to thank you about like choosing me to talk about this, and because finally someone highlighted and shed the lights on the role of the interpreter. You know what I call the interpreter? To be honest, I call them the unknown soldiers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, without this job, it is almost impossible for like many missions to be completed. And being interpreter in like such diverse and dynamic environments requires a wide like range of skills and you know what, thirst for knowledge. So after I start working as interpreter, it is worth mentioning that interpretation is such an incredible job. And I'll tell you why. So interpreters are like, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but interpreters are very, very intelligent people. I mean, first of all, it's not only about language. It's not only about translating and interpreting. It's that you have to be like very, very open-minded and, you know what, accept and respect everybody's opinion and thoughts. And I mean, second thing is that you have to be always ready to be exposed to different mentalities because not everybody's thinking the same. You will meet people think differently and you have to deal with it. You have to have the ability to deal with it, yeah? One other thing is you have to do a lot of research and like understand different cultures and backgrounds because you will be exposed to that. And you have to show respect to that. And you know what? And it's very, very, very hard job to do. I mean, needless to say, some of the people you will interact with will treat you with envy, thinking that, I mean, you're working as an interpreter and you have all the money, all the power and resources to be able to do such a job. But you know what? I mean, others will have the opposite thoughts. I mean, they will treat you kind and yeah. And you know what? I found working as an interpreter is a very interesting job to do, to be honest. Sometimes it doesn't require you to have any education education degrees or like, you know what, you don't have to study for it. But the only thing that you need is the skills of speaking certain language and, you know what, also the ability to understand and respect people.
Yeah, and I think you're almost like a cultural bridge as well, because you have a Western coalition force trying to communicate with a military that operates differently, different cultural context entirely, and you're the kind of bridge between that and kind of got to give the advice of, oh, you know, maybe it's not a good time to say that, or we do the tea first for half an hour before we talk about these things. You know, do you feel that you had to give the local context, which we can miss
that's,
out on?
That's absolutely right. You know what, Emma? I'm going to have to ask you a question. What do you think the hardest thing for the interpreter to interpret?
I don't know, would it be specific language, military terms that you might not have an English equivalent for, or medical terms that you don't know the English equivalent for?
You know what's the hardest thing
what?
To translate is, or to interpret? A joke.
A joke, yeah, okay, because humour would be so different.
It is, yeah. It is very, very difficult.
Yes. And people use that as a bridge on the way.
I mean, it's very hard to convey the idea of the joke to, like, from an Iraqi culture to an Australian or like American or whatever the
yes
the equivalent is. It's very hard, and you know what? You have to make the Australians or like the Americans to laugh as bad as how funny the joke was told by the Iraqis.
Yes, so and lots of pressure.
And if they don't laugh, I mean, it's so absurd situation. I mean, How can you explain it for the Iraqis or the Australians that it wasn't as funny as it is in Iraq? Or like, you know what?
Yes.
It's very...
it didn't land.
Yeah. So, I mean, once again, working as an interpreter is a very interesting job. Not only like you will interact with different people, but you will be exposed to many different resources and you will learn so much knowledge of it. I mean, I'll give some examples. We mentioned about like medical terminology or like military terminology. I had zero knowledge about them. I had zero knowledge about weapons, ammo, like medical terminology and all of these stuff. And it was military ranks. I've never known what a captain or like a colonel or, you know what, I've never been exposed to these kind of things. So all of this made me like spend a lot of time, I mean, doing my researches. And you know what, gain so much knowledge about it and gain so much knowledge about like weapons and how they work and, you know what, ranks and what military orders or like medical tools, you know what, and medical interventions and medical military equipment. I mean, to be a successful interpreter, you have to have every possible knowledge about, I mean, so many aspects of the military and not only military, like so many different aspects. Sometimes, I mean, you'd be in a situation that you have to, I mean, you have absolutely no clue about what you're translating about, but you have to be smart enough to ask indirect questions or like to investigate about what's been told and what should be translated. And you know what, just seek clarification and you know what, explain it the way you think it's right to be explained. I mean, I used to conduct, and as you remember, like I used to conduct a lot of KLEs, logistics, medical training, supply, like intel, whatever, name it. And sometimes I'm requested for a KLE that I have no idea. I have like zero clue about what's the like the KLE is going to be about.
So key leadership engagement.
Yeah.
Just for those. Yep. Yep.
Yep.
So and basically people getting together and talking strategy or making plans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? I had to remain like composed and resilient and be ready for everything. I mean, you will definitely have your ups and downs, but you always have to keep like your things together and like overcome any challenge you might face during the day, you know?
You did that really well. I want to ask you sort of about the sentiment in Iraq. I guess Australia was part of that US coalition in the first Gulf War that invaded Iraq, and we were there from, you know, the 90s to 2003 on and off doing that. And then after Saddam was ousted, then there was that ongoing invasion, and then a short couple of years later, 2013-17, with the rise of ISIS, we were now back as a partner force working with the Iraqi military that we'd previously been fighting against. Given that history, I was really surprised at how welcoming and friendly pretty much everyone I met in Iraq, military or not, was. But what was the general vibe on the street? Was there a bit of resentment or sort of hatred there against the West after that initial occupation invasion and then coming back to work together? Or
so the sentiment among like my friends, my family regarding Australia during that time varied, to be honest. Just because the conflict was always about the US, the Americans, so the United States, they always mentioned like these that so Australia or even like some other countries that were part of the coalition forces that invaded Iraq, I mean, never been mentioned. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, when I was young, I had absolutely no clue that there were countries rather than the US involved in the invasion.
Because they were the vast majority for sure in terms of numbers and boots on the ground.
Yeah.
So were your friends sort of like, oh, do you really want to go and work with them? Or were they supportive? Or did you get a bit of a mix?
I've never talked about this with my friends. I mean, and if I want to do something, I'll do it. I mean, if I know that this is the right thing to do for me, I'll do it. And I think only during ISIS where like people start to realize the contribution of like other countries other than the US. So a lot of them like view the Australia's role involving in like the US lead coalition like more positively, I would say, and like recognizing the efforts to like combat terrorism and, you know what, support logistically. You could sense like the hatred of like some of the soldiers and the officers towards the coalition forces and even more for the interpreters. And I don't blame them, to be honest, like due to the impact of the war and, I mean, the bad situation that happened to them and their families, their beloved ones. And you can't blame them for this, but still you find, I mean, as you mentioned, you find the hospitality and like respect from most of the others, you know?
Yeah, and such a short time frame as well. It wasn't, you know, 40 years apart. It was, you know, within a decade. We sort of incredibly welcoming as a people was certainly my experience. What about access to medical care growing up? I know a lot of health professionals did leave Iraq because they had the means to, so many doctors and that migrated to the West early on, particularly when things were becoming more violent. Did that affect your ability, you know, to go to hospital if you needed as a child or your family?
You know what, like the access to healthcare in Iraq, I mean, I'm talking about like early 2000s, and it was kind of like mixed picture. We're talking about like a country that is going through wars most of the time, and like, you know what, political conflicts. This would definitely like lead to heaps of challenges for citizens, especially, I mean, people in like rural areas, and as well as for the health professionals. You know what, under Saddam's regime, I mean, the government invested heavily in healthcare and education sectors as it was like mandatory to attend school. Actually studying was like the gateway for many adults to evade like compulsory military deployments. So they would fail themselves and like intentionally just to not join the military, you know. And I believe like the migration of many doctors and health professionals was due to Saddam oppression, being obligated to perform like certain things the way Saddam's wanted. You know what, however, the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s and followed by the first Gulf War?
Yes.
In the 1991 and the years of like international sanctions. This had taken toll on like the country's healthcare infrastructure. So the country, like I'm talking about Iraq, suffered from medical supplies shortage, and hospitals often struggles with like inadequate resources. After 2003, and especially during 2006 to 2008, I would say this was the time of a civil war that started between so many groups in Iraq, and most of these groups are trying like to take over. So this put like huge burden on health professionals and hospitals being fully loaded with like injured civilians, exposed to like different injuries, and you know, and yeah, it was widespread, and yeah, it was kind of dangerous during that time. And you know what, being able like to access healthcare was very challenging for many people. As I mentioned, like the country was shorted by supplies. And you know what? One other thing is that we lack some of the schemes that is offered here in Australia, for example, like Medicare or having a concession card, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, some other schemes as well that could help the citizen financially. But you still could go to the hospital and, you know what, being checked for very low cost during that time. And yeah, there were also like many, many private clinics you could visit if you could afford it.
Yeah. So it really becomes a healthcare system with those that can afford to, or those that can pay, kind of getting the service, yeah. And those that can't miss out. I guess the other thing, whilst you were working as an interpreter, you're traveling every day and living in Baghdad, vehicle-borne, improvised explosive devices, and then there was a lot of coordinated terror attacks as well in public places. That kind of hit the news a lot. How was that living there day to day? Were you kind of fearful going about your daily life and commuting to work?
How do you think it was? Hectic.
I reckon it would be scary, yeah. The coalition didn't even want to drive anywhere. They flew everywhere because they were so worried about getting blown
Absolutely.
Up. And then you're rolling in your Mini.
The dream car.
You know, so it wasn't up armored Mini, was it?
Yeah. So, I mean, when such incidents become a regular occurrence, people may develop like a sense of numbness towards this, and you know what, they start to accept as like they're coping to deal with such situation and deal with the constant threat to their safety, despite like the initial shock and fear that these attacks may elicit over time. Individuals like living in such environments may adapt to the heightened security measures and like the ever present risk of violence. But this adaptation doesn't mean that people become indifferent to the suffering for the loss caused by, I mean, these attacks, you know? I mean, people are losing their family members, their relatives, their friends. But rather that, I mean, they learn to carry on and, you know what, with the daily lives and despite the ongoing threats.
Yeah, incredibly resilient.
It is very essential to recognize that this kind of adaptation, doesn't imply complete immunity to like the psychological impact of this kind of violence. But people still may experience anxiety, you know, a trauma, fear of like going out and, or maybe like even thinking about their family members and, you know what, their friends, they might lose them at any time. So it is very hard to cope with such kind of situation. I mean, you know what, everything that started as a new, it is very bizarre, yeah? It is very odd. But once it become regular thing, like regular occurrence, on a daily basis, I mean, this is what becomes the norm, yeah? I mean, when it's safe and quiet, sometimes during this kind of situation, it is hectic all the time, most of the time, okay? Like, I remember, especially during 2006, 2008, and even up to when the war against ISIS started, I can't remember a day without hearing a car bomb. I can't remember a day without like opening the door and hear a gunfire. It's just hectic. And I mean, people are in big fear of just going out of their homes, you know? I've witnessed myself like so many occasions where I was, I would say, a couple minutes behind or after the explosion. I was so lucky, like couple of minutes behind or after. I still remember like the first time I heard, and it was so close, IDF, like in direct fire. That was my first experience with explosions. I think I was 13, 14 years old. I was playing soccer with my friends in the neighborhood, and I only heard the whistle of the rocket launching. I didn't hear the explosion. And it fell on a huge storage, like very big building near the ground where we were playing. And I still remember the sound of the sharpness, like the fragments flying off. And you know what, getting closer and closer, like I could still hear the sound, ding, 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 getting closer and closer to me, no? And I remember that we ran behind like a building and waited for the whole situation to be over. Then I rushed back to home, and I mean, found all, like, even my family, like all the families. So we have bunkers underneath the buildings that where I used to live. And they were all like gathered down in the bunkers. And I still can remember the fear in the faces of my family, my friends, and how frightened the people were, and the children especially.
Yeah, sure.
And you know what? There's another experience I will share with you as well. Okay, I remember this one, and we're during Ramadan now, so it's kind of like a tradition in most of the Arab countries is to celebrate break fasting the month, yeah. So people normally just go do shopping, buy new clothes and stuff. So I remember I went myself and my brother to buy new clothes, and we took them to the tailor to fix them. And that is the time when the Bluetooth headphones came up. And there was this small shop in the corner, like close to the tailor. And my brother was like, I want to go and ask about the price of these headphones and stuff. And I was like, you know what, we're too late. And I mean, we spent a lot of time just doing the shopping and stuff, and we need to go home right now. We have to go to the tailor, and then we need to go home. And he was like, please just let me go and ask about the price. And at that moment, I turned around and I saw a car parking behind us. And it was like an old car. I can't remember what car was it, but it was very old car that parked behind us. And I was like, you know what, when you have that feeling that there's something's going to happen? And I told my brother, let's go right now, okay? Let's go. And I literally grabbed, he's my older brother. So I literally grabbed his hand and went to the tailor's shop. As soon as we stepped in, that car that parked behind us blew up. It was 2-3 meters away from us. And if we only like went inside and asked about the prices, we'd have been gone. And I still remember like people trying to help and support like the injured civilians, and the dragging them on the floor. And I still remember the face of, oh my God, that guy, he was like absolutely damaged top to bottom, and blood all over his body, and injured, and he was, I still remember his looks at me, And I was standing there just frightened. And you know what? And I don't know what to do. I was too young. I was like 14. Still, yeah. And I had zero experience about these kind of situation. And I will never, ever forget about this my whole life.
What a childhood, the good and the bad, but you would have seen the best and worst in humanity growing up there, I imagine.
Yeah. Sometimes when I like talk about this to some of the friends that I made here, I mean, they ask me if I'm still in my mind, like if I'm still mentally stable and you know what, going through all of these situations, and it's hectic.
Bearing all that in mind and the security situation, I imagine it wouldn't have been too tough a decision when you had the opportunity to get out, or was it still really hard to leave members of your family when you moved to Australia?
It wasn't definitely a tough decision. I mean, to move to Australia. I mean, despite all the challenges and the uncertainties that, I mean, come with moving to a new country, it is hard. But I mean, the safety, the stability that's been offered to me outweighed, I mean, any concerns, any thoughts that might be, change my mind. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, after experiencing, I mean, difficult situation and, I mean, the hardships in Baghdad, I mean, the opportunity to provide a better and, like, more secure future for my family is number one. And it was, a clear, compelling choice. I can't deny, like, this was maybe the best choices I've ever made in my life. While any move involves adjustments and, you know what, challenges, I mean, the decision to relocate to Australia was ultimately a positive and, you know what, inevitable step for my family, first of all, I mean, for their well-being and future prospects, you know. And I could never wish for more than being offered to move to Australia. I mean, to this incredible country, to be honest. I mean, really, it is a blessing for people to be, you know what, it is a blessing for people to be born here and, you know what, have the opportunity, I mean, to live in Australia. I know, I mean, lots of people are like complaining and, you know what, about how hard it is to live here. But I can't imagine, I mean, seeing those people who are always complaining, I mean, living in the same situation I experienced back home, you know?
You just feel like telling them to quit their whinging a little bit sometimes. I mean, I'm not discounting that people don't experience hardship in Australia at all. Yeah. But we forget how fortunate we are with everything, even, as you said, like the Medicare system. Education, mm-hmm. The security situation.
I mean, you know what? The funny thing is, some of the interpreters that worked with us, I mean, been offered this opportunity and refused to move to Australia. And some of them, you know what, came here and they didn't like living here. I mean, they said it's just hard. It's not them. Some of them complained about like, can't finding job opportunities. Others saying is costly to study or like, you know what, to live, to manage to afford living. I know some people like are ready to work their butts off just to make enough money to live and afford, I mean, afford this life, you know what? But you have no idea what it's like to live with, I mean, the hard situation and back home, I mean, and you know what, it's just too hard for people, like if, for example, living with no water or like no electricity for a couple of days, it is just so hard. Okay, all I can say is like I'm thankful for the opportunity I was given, and I'm 100% sure that I will make the best of it.
Well, you already are, I think, mate. You've been working since you got here, and you've started studying nursing. Was what mm-hmm. prompted that? Just working with other fantastic nurses like myself, or
absolutely. I mean, you
inspired.
You guys were the main reason.
I'm not paying you to say that.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, you really did initiate that inspiration of becoming a part of like the healthcare system in Australia. Well, I mean, when I moved here, my plans, it wasn't about like nursing or, you know what, it wasn't about this at all. I was thinking of keep doing interpretation and translation. But then, you know what, I thought of myself, like, I had my chance in this kind of field, and I was kind of rewarded with coming to Australia. So why not just pursuing a different career, okay? And when I tried to apply, like, for studying like nursing, I couldn't meet the requirements at first, because I had to finish like Cert 3 in medical field in Australia before like applying for nursing. And I finished Cert 3 in pathology collection course, and then such privilege that nursing became free of cost. And that was a bonus, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I finished my PATH course and then started nursing. I haven't finished it yet, so, I've been very, very privileged to pursue this career, to be honest.
So do you need to do clinical placements as part of that?
I finished my aged care placement, and I've got another placement coming up soon, in a couple of months, and I'll be finishing my first year. Yeah, and I still have 1 year left. So.
And you're a phlebotomist, so you can go and take people's blood, and
we're the legal vampires. That's what they call us.
I love it. Any interesting stories from placements, or have they all been pretty good? People being nice to you? You haven't got any of those old dragon nurses breathing down your back?
So during placement, I mean, I've witnessed how vulnerable and delicate the elderly people were. It was an aged care placement. Yeah. And I mean, It is very hard to deal with like elderly, especially they have like so many conditions and stuff, and you have to like to be very, very careful how to apply your skills. And this is like my first placement, so it was kind of challenging. But I mean, taking into considerations like the conditions they are going through and how to care for them. I mean, you have to have like the empathy and like willingness to be able to care for them, you know? And I actually had built a very good relationship with one of the residents in that aged care facility. She was from Iraq too. And there was a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding due to language barrier. And you know what? I had to use my interpretation skills again.
Fantastic. And I'm sure it won't be the last time in your career. Yeah,
definitely. And
aged care nurses are very special. I think it's a really tough job that doesn't get highlighted. And working with our most vulnerable and precious elderly population, I don't think I could do it you know, no one gets better.
I had the chance to go back and visit this resident again. She was absolutely happy to see me again. And you know what? I mean, seeing the smile on her face, it was, I mean, maybe like the best reward I could ever have, you know?
So what's next for you? Another year of training?
I've seen like an interview with one of the richest people in the world, okay? And the host asked him, how did you manage to like become what you are right now? So this guy pulled out a chick book from his pocket and asked the host to write whatever number she wanted, okay? And he would sign for it. He would sign for the check. Next thing, she will have the money. Okay. And then this lady was like, are you serious? Like, are you going to do this on air? And he asked her again to write whatever number she wanted again. Okay. And then she was like, no, this is not happening. You're not going to do this. Then he taught her like the biggest and I would say like the best lesson in life. And he said, I mean, you had the chance and offered another one and still didn't get that chance. And you had the chance to become like me. I mean, basically, and to be like the richest woman in the world as well. And you would never like do this job again, but still you missed the opportunity twice. And he told her that I had that chance once and once only in my life, and I chose to like take the risk to become what I am right now, and it was worth it, you know. So I overcame like my biggest challenge already, and I took full responsibility for making the decision to move to Australia and build my own future and like, you know what, work hard for it. And I've chosen like to provide my family with like the best quality of life possible. I mean, being able to live like a life stress-free and like stable and not to worry too much about like, you know what, living costs, rent, working, making money. And this only like would bring burden and stress to your day. So I've already achieved like my number one goal, I would say, and I'm in my highest state of satisfaction, and whatever comes over it, it's just a bonus for me. So what's next for me is keep doing what I'm doing, and you know what, just keep my family safe and pursue happiness and pursue whatever is the best for me and for my family. I mean, I think that's what next for me.
Baha, you are an inspiration. And I just want to say thank you for your service.
Thank you so much, Emma. Absolutely. That was a pleasure and honor to be part of your podcast. I really, really appreciate it.